From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Mitchell Zukov's new book tells two stories, one from the past and one that's still playing out today. There are three American military airplanes in the story from the past. All three go down in Greenland during World War II. There's a cargo plane that slams into an ice cap during a blizzard. The crew survives, and in the ensuing search, the two other planes are lost. Zukov's last book was also about a survival story and a military plane crash, but this is different in many ways, most of all because Zukov himself plays a part in it. He becomes so invested in the story that he becomes part of an expedition to recover one of the planes. Today in the program, he'll join us to weave together the two strands of the story and the effort to solve one of the last mysteries of World War II. Join us after the news.
Hi, this is Elaine Clark, one of the producers of Radio West. Our free podcasts are made possible by KUER's generous listeners. If you're a fan, we invite you to put $10 in our tip jar. Text KUER to 85944 to make that donation. Thank you.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In November of 1942, these are the early days of World War II, there was an operation to send American warplanes to the fighting in Europe through the North. It was what they called the Snowball Route, a series of landing fields and bases in Canada and Iceland and Greenland. The journalist Mitchell Zukov says one of the problems with this plan was that flying over Greenland sometimes meant flying into Greenland. The forbidden weather and the terrain made the conditions impossible at times. Zukov's new book is about three military planes that, in fact, do go down in Greenland during the war. It begins with a cargo plane, and then two search planes are lost. The book is about these adventures, the moments of disaster and of survival and rescue. And there are remarkable characters in the books from the past and in the present, because really there are two stories playing out here. One from 71 years ago. The other is still playing out. It's an expedition to recover one of these planes still buried in Greenland, covered in ice and snow. The book is called Frozen in Time, and Mitchell Zukov is joining us today to talk about it. Mitchell Zukov is a professor of journalism at Boston University. He's the author of six books, including Lost in Shangri-La. And he's joining us today from a studio in Brookline, Massachusetts. And Mitchell Zukov, welcome back. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Doug.
Well, I wanted to – I referenced Lost in Shangri-La, a previous book that we had you on talking about, which I should say was about another plane crash, military plane crash in World War II. And I wanted to sort of get this out of the way and talk about what sort of connection there might be, because you've said you didn't really want to replicate that story. And in fact, you even said it almost made you reconsider telling this one.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And so I hesitated here. I didn't want to be known as the weird plane crash World War II guy.
Right.
You know, first he goes to one big island, New Guinea, and then he goes to this other big island, Greenland. And then, you know, my wife kept asking me if there were any plane crashes in Hawaii. So I did. I hesitated because I was very happy with Lost in Shangri-La. It was the book that I wanted to write, and I'm happy with how it came out. And I was never interested in replicating that or becoming the genre guy.
Mm.
But this story, because as you described, it has this modern element, and it is so different from Lost in Shangri-La in that way. And also because this was a story that I felt that had I not told it, it might never get told. And this was an opportunity. So I felt both called to it and obliged. There was an obligation, I felt, to do this book.
Hmm. Well, let's talk about how you found it. It's interesting. I'm not sure if this is something you regularly do, but you've talked about going through these old newspaper archives, looking for, as you've described them, hidden treasures.
Hmm.
And then you come upon this story. Is this something – are you looking for something in particular?
You know, there's a little bit of free association that goes on, Doug, where I love reading old newspapers. As you mentioned, I'm a journalism professor. I guess I'm a newspaper nerd in that way. again, you know, my students kid me that I'm really just looking at the old brassiere ads. But I just love newspapers. And so, and I've realized that we tell stories differently now than we did back then. As good as the reporters were, as good as the journalists and writers were, we now understand that there are large stories to be told in small events or seemingly small or microcosmic events. Mm. And so I'm convinced that there is sort of an endless number of untold great stories that reveal something about humanity, something about, in this case, survival, mm-hmm. but about resilience and about friendship and about what it takes to rely on each other so completely. All these other themes can emerge from what seem at the moment, perhaps in 1942 in a newspaper story, like just a story about a plane crash yeah. and, oh, what happened to these guys? And there are these larger themes. So I do keep going back and back to these wonderful newspaper archives that I'm so glad still exist, and because I'm sure there are more stories, and I think I've found a few more, in fact.
Yeah. I wonder if in some way, and we'll get to this as we go along, but you come to play a role in this story, certainly the modern part of all of this. That must have thrown you off a little bit as a journalism professor.
It's a great observation, Doug. It did. I hesitated because there had always been, and there has always been in my career, a bright line. The story is not about me is sort of the mantra that I use and that most journalists that I know believe in. And so I hesitated again and again any time it started seeming that I was playing too big a role or, as we can talk about later, reaching into my wallet yeah. and doing all these things. And I realized that there was no other way to do it, that I had to, as long as I was transparent and in the sense that I was going to disclose everything that I did, there was a way to continue being journalistically ethical. My integrity would not be compromised as long as I disclosed to readers, hey, I got swept up in this. This is as true as anything, despite the fact that, yes, I am now a participant.
Yeah. Was it hard to write personal pronouns, I and me? And
I had spent 30 years beating I and me out of my system.
Yeah.
My fingers did not want to type those. And fortunately, my wife, who's also a journalist, is a photojournalist, is my first reader. And she kept, you know, I would tell her all these stories about what was happening and what we were doing. And she fortunately sort of sat me down and said, why am I the only person you're willing to share these with? You are a character. Get over it.
Yeah. Let's talk about the setting for the story, which is, of course, Greenland. Now, at the top of one of the chapters early in the book, you write this: Greenland makes no sense. Describe it, because you have to understand the context of the forbidding territory and the cold to really get a sense of this story.
Yes. Yeah, as most school children remember, Greenland is the most misnamed place on the planet. There's nothing green there. That was a kind of a canard, an attempt by Leif Erikson's son to convince other Icelanders to move there as though it was a paradise. But in fact, it is a giant block of ice. It's almost a bowl of ice. The weight of the ice cap in the center of this enormous island, the world's largest island, has depressed the land in the middle to the point where there's 2 miles thick ice, deep ice, 10,000 feet deep. And then at the edge of the coastline of this enormous, enormous coastline are these mountains. So it's almost like a bowl with cracked edges. And through these cracks, the glaciers move and toward their destiny as icebergs. Mm. And this is a place where there's a magic spot on the thermometer, 40 degrees below zero. It's the one place where Celsius and Fahrenheit agree. That's Greenland. And then you add in these Pitarac storms, which I experienced when I was there, where building up, if you have hundreds and hundreds of miles of unbroken landscape in the center of the island, the winds just have endless time to build and pick up glacial dust and ice, and they come in at you at over 100 miles an hour routinely, and with this glacial dust, and it can scour your glasses, if you have glasses. If you don't have glasses, you can be blinded. So this is a place also where, because of the weather patterns, the ground and sky often blend into one. It becomes a place where you don't know, you literally do not know up from down. Pilots or men during World War II would describe walking out of a tent or a little hut and falling over. These were healthy young men because they lost their sense of balance because the gray of the sky and the gray of the ice cap blended so perfectly, they lost all sense of balance.
We should mention that this becomes relevant, of course, because during the war, American leaders, as you say in the book, became really concerned about Greenland being so close to the United States. And so the United States, it becomes part of this plan, this operation. And there becomes this kind of Greenland patrol. And now all of a sudden, this is a place where, despite the forbidding climate and the terrain, American military planes do have to kind of negotiate Greenland now.
Exactly. The choice was breaking down the planes and putting them on ships where they would be prey for the U-boats, the German U-boats in the Atlantic. And so instead, they flew them this snowball route that you mentioned, this Operation Bolero. And so the main street of that route was Greenland. Right. They would often land on the west coast at a couple of bases. One was called BW-1, and they'd fly over to the east coast to Bluey East, BE-8. And so we had hundreds of planes going along this route. So inevitably, some of them weren't going to make it because they had this experience that I describe in the book that pilots named flying in milk.
Yeah.
This feeling of the sky and earth coming together into one grayish mass. Some described it as like flying inside a cotton ball. And so Operation Bolero, I can't prove this, but I've always believed that part of the understanding among military leaders was that there's going to be a certain amount of loss based purely on the weather, attributable to nothing other than Greenland.
Yeah. Let's talk about the first plane in this story. It's a C-53 cargo plane. It's called the Sky Trooper, but you say the name is more impressive than the plane itself. And this is where we meet one of the story's first great characters, Homer McDowell Jr. Talk about that plane, and let's talk about Homer.
Sure. Well, the C-53, as you mentioned, it's the Buick of the sky.
Right.
It's nothing flashy. It's a cargo plane. That's what the C stands for. And Homer McDowell is this guy. He's just leading this 5-man crew. He was extremely well liked. The guys, he was based actually in Greenland. They were flying a cargo mission from Iceland back over to Greenland on this day, on November 5th, 1942. And Homer encounters this experience of flying in milk as he crosses back over the east coast of Greenland, and where he thinks he's going to see mountains, or he thinks he's going to see something that he can use as a landmark. There's only white and there's only gray. And so incredibly, though, he brings the plane down in a way that keeps all 5 men alive. And that by itself, to survive a plane crash in Greenland, is amazing. And the plane is intact enough that he even has his radio working.
Yeah.
And so he is able to put out SOS calls and emergency beacon calls to say, hey, this is where I thought I was last. I thought I was at 9,000 feet, but I'm really at 2,000 feet. Please, we have very limited time. Come get us.
This brings us to a section that I wanted to talk about, because the ever-present sense of in these stories is the cold. So as you say, Homer McDowell, who, by the way, had just celebrated his 29th birthday, you mentioned. I think that's important because these guys were really young. I mean, we think about them in other ways, but I don't know. I found that really striking how young all of these guys were.
I love that point, Doug. I'm not so young anymore, and I think of these guys as the age of, in many cases, my students, 21, 23. you know, and suddenly entrusted with, and I don't want to over-dramatize it, but these were the guys who we had entrusted to basically save the world. In World War II, in all their little roles, flying a cargo plane, flying a bomber, leading a group of men up a hill, these were the men who we asked to rescue us from this danger. And we put so much responsibility on their shoulders at very, very tender ages. And in fact, Homer was one of the older guys in the story.
Let me so Homer, as you say, he brings the plane down without it breaking apart. They now have some shelter. It's not great, though. You mentioned they have no gear for long-term survival. They have no heavy clothing, no sleeping bags, no way to generate heat. So I wonder, you – again, we're going to get to your being in Greenland. But do you have any sense at all what it's like, that cold, that persistent, constant cold?
Oh, I do, largely from their accounts or the accounts of those who made it, as well as my limited experience relative to theirs. It is a living beast. It is something I describe it in the book as it's like a python. It squeezes the life out of you slowly. It can be excruciating because it is something you can't fight. You can try, but it slowly takes over your body. And it is a presence from the moment you're awake to the moment you go to sleep. And you can't even sleep well because you're feeling your extremities numb. You can't even feel your respiration slowing from the cold as it squeezes you.
Mm. Read this section, if you would. This is about... again, you'll hear references to Homer McDowell. This is from the book, Frozen in Time.
Adding to the crew's problems, snowstorms made search flights difficult or impossible for several days after the crash. If many more days passed, or if windblown snow covered the C-53, time would begin running out for McDowell and his men. Whatever rations they had would soon be crumbs. The cold would slow their movements and their minds. Their enemy was no longer Hitler and Hirohito, but hypothermia. When the C-53 crew members' body temperatures fell below 95 degrees Fahrenheit, shivering would become pronounced. As it fell further, their extremities would turn blue. Severe hypothermia would set in when body temperatures fell below 82 degrees. At 68 degrees, doctors would label their condition profound. Laymen would call it horrible. Speech would become labored or slurred. They'd grow confused. Their hands would become useless. Some men might become agitated or irrational. Some might lose their wits and try burrowing in the plain or the snow in a desperate bid for warmth. Paradoxically, some might strip off their clothes in delusional fits. Some might fall into a stupor. As their bodies stopped trying to stay warm, their heart rates, breathing, and blood pressure would drop. Two breaths a minute, then one. Their pupils would dilate. Major organs would fail. At some point during the physical decline, some might succumb to a toxic mix of anxiety and sadness. In the heat of battle, there's no time to think about a telegram from the War Department arriving at a loved one's door. In the cold of a wrecked airplane on the Greenland ice cap, there's nothing but time.
That's Mitchell Zuckoff reading from his book, Frozen in Time, an epic story of survival and a modern quest for lost heroes of World War II. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the journalist Mitchell Zuckoff is back with us. When he was on the program a few years ago with us, he was telling of a plane crash during World War II and an amazing story of survival. Well, he's at it again. His latest book is another story of survival. But actually, there are two stories here, one from the past, another from the present. Three planes go down in the frozen Arctic conditions of Greenland during World War II. But this is also about the modern-day expedition to find the plane, and we'll talk about that as we go along. The book is called Frozen in Time, an epic story of survival and a modern quest for lost heroes of World War II. Mitchell Zuckoff is joining us from a studio in Brookline, Massachusetts. So we have one plane that goes down, Mitchell Zuckoff, and so the search begins. And at the time you mentioned Greenland had plenty of planes nearby to help, and one enlisted in the search is a B-17 bomber. Talk about this, because you mentioned the B-17 has a reputation for being able to, as you say in the book, you know, dish out and take a good bit of punishment. And what's interesting, it seems like there's this kind of reverence about this plane. You even mentioned in the special oath the bombardiers take in the B-17.
The B-17 was the flying fortress. Yeah. It is, and it deserved its legendary reputation. It was a backbone of our efforts, the United States' efforts, to win the war in Europe and beyond. And it did. The men who flew these B-17s overwhelmingly still talk about them with such reverence that this plane got me home. Yeah. It came in with, you know, and they would count the bullet holes and, you know, of the four engines, only one was still working at the end after the punishment it would take in a fight. But it would always get them home.
Yeah.
And so the B-17 was a big part of our Operation Bolero. We needed to get them over to Europe. And so we brought in these crews. These weren't even officially, for the most part, bombardier crews.
Yeah.
They were transport crews to bring them. But going back to your point, Doug, about the bombardier's oath, they were entrusted with this incredible Norden bomb sight. This was the most advanced piece of technology that the American military had, I believe. And its reputation was able to put a bomb in a pickle jar from 10,000 feet.
Yeah.
And it was a very primitive to us computer, but at the time, it was this secret sauce of our bombing effort. And so the bombardier of every B-17 was required to take this special oath that said he would give his life rather than give up his bomb sight.
Yeah. This particular plane that comes into your story now, it's a brand new bomber, hadn't even been named yet. And you even describe the smell of the plane. It had that new plane smell, they said.
Yes. It's this the pilots from those days, some of whom I've been privileged to get to know, they talk about this bouquet of solvents and grease and leather and a little bit of plexiglass and new metal and the welds. And it just had what they described as this new plane smell.
The pilot of this plane is this low-key guy from California, Armin Monteverdi. Describe him as being built like a wrestler. He's short and he's stout and he's broad-shouldered, a gentle kind of guy. And he goes through the same thing that Homer McDowell goes through in many ways. He is flying in the intense cold of Greenland, and he goes into this experience of flying in this Arctic milk. And the plane, well, I want you to go through this story because they don't just go down. I mean, he has this choice he has to make, and they have this option. Do they turn? Do they climb? I mean, take us through this part of the story.
Sure. So Armin Monteverdi is sitting with his co-pilot, Harry Spencer, and they are flying up this fjord, this bay. And they're flying into milk, and they know it. And they know that at the head of the bay, there's a rising glacier, and that they don't know how fast it's going to rise because their altimeter only tells them their altitude over sea level, yeah, not the altitude over the rising glacier. So they know that something is up ahead, but they're flying in a cloud, effectively. Mm-hmm. And so they can't see it, but they can kind of sense it, and they know it's out there. So as they're coming up the fjord, this Koji Bay fjord, they have to decide, do we keep flying ahead? Do we try and raise altitude? Can we do it fast enough to avoid the onrushing glacier? Do we turn? Or do we even bail out? And they abandon that idea quickly because they understand it's safer, at least. They feel more secure inside a B-17 than they would in a parachuting over a glacier. So they have this terrible decision, this really Hobbes choice to make, and they decide we're going to turn. We're going to dip the left wing. We think we have about 1,000 feet or more above the glacier,
but they don't know, right? I mean, they have no actual sense of it, right?
Correct. It's flying by gut instinct and hoping for the best. And they know, both Harry Spencer and as you mentioned, the pilot, Armin Monteverdi, they have seven other lives in their hands at this moment. The rest of their crew, as well as three other men they brought aboard, who were acting as searchers to try and find Homer McDowell's lost C-53. So they're making a decision about their lives, about the lives of the men, who most of whom they know and they care about. But they do decide, we have to turn. We can't keep going straight ahead. We're going to nose into this glacier if we do. And so they dip the left wing. But almost as soon as they do, 30 degrees or so, not even a full turn, it clips the top of the glacier.
Yeah.
And suddenly it bounces back up. But now the belly of the plane goes down. And this giant B-17 bomber, this flying fortress, is effectively turned into a giant bobsled.
Yeah.
It's racing across, carving a groove across the top of this glacier. It's going across open crevasses, and it just they're trying to stop. And incredibly, as they're going, the weight and the pounding that it takes on, as it hits, it breaks the plane in half. From right behind the radio compartment. So the tail section actually falls back. And when it finally comes to a stop, several men are thrown out of the plane. One of them, Paul Spina, whom you mentioned, is actually thrown up and through a window on the top of the plane out into the snow with a broken arm, and he passes out in the snow. And so now this the plane is just called by its radio numbers, the PN-9E.
Right.
The crew have to find each other, and they're still in the midst of a raging snowstorm, and find a way to get back into the tail section, which is the only place with enough room that still hasn't been crushed or damaged enough for them to take some kind of refuge in this open, ripped open tail section.
Mm. But all nine crew members are alive. I mean, that's extraordinary.
Extraordinary is right. Yes.
Now that brings us to the third plane in the story, because now you have a search for not just the cargo plane, but now the B-17 bomber. And this brings up my favorite plane, I have to say, Mitchell Zuckoff, the Grumman Duck.
Yes.
Let's talk about that plane. They're 34 feet long, 14 feet high, as you describe in the book. And you sort of say it's roughly the size of a school bus, and it's pretty wieldy, pretty clunky, this plane.
Yeah. It looks like it has about the same chance of getting off the ground as a school bus.
Right.
It looks like it was melded together with spare parts. It's got the biplane wings of almost like of a World War I, a Sopwith Camel. It has this giant surfboard amphibious float on its bottom. It has these two other floats hanging off the bottom of its wings that look like little torpedoes. It has not really a cockpit. It has, you know, on top of the plane, this tandem, like a tandem bicycle, front and rear for the pilot and his radio man. And it's got this compartment beneath them. And it's just, it really looks like something Disney might have drawn and put a smile on its face and said, you know, here's the pudgy little airplane that could.
It's so remarkable. It must have taken some skill. And I want you to sort of talk about how it works, because you talk about how they are basically, they're on these, tied to the Coast Guard cutters. They hang from ropes suspended over the deck of these boats. So you have to kind of crank them down. It's a kind of a process.
Oh, yeah. The pilot and the radio man get in, and then they're swung over the side of the, in this case, the U.S. Coast Guard cutter Northland. And then they are lowered in at the pilot's direction, with his thumbs up or thumbs down, down into the water right next to this Coast Guard cutter.
Yeah.
And they splash in, and they then manually release this hook that's holding the plane. And then, because of how this plane was unfortunately designed, the pilot has almost no forward vision over the front of the engine or the propeller. And so he kind of looks – he kind of has to crane his neck or look sideways as he taxis away from the ship. And he's trying to avoid little what were called growlers, which were miniature icebergs in the waters. He would have to just try and find a clear path to get up. And incredibly, again and again, this one particular Coast Guard pilot, John Pritchard, found a way to do that. He was an enormously skilled pilot.
He's a great character, too, Mitchell Zhukov, John Pritchard. You tell a story of it also in I think it's also in November of 1942. This Canadian Air Force crew of three goes down, and yes. Pritchard is instrumental in rescuing them, and he is determined. And I think this is the thing that is so intriguing about this is you write about Pritchard and Benjamin Bottoms, the other part of that little crew, and their sense of commitment, but also their sense of urgency.
Yes. These are two remarkable guys. I can, even after all this time of thinking and talking about them, I can choke up just thinking about them. They were Coast Guard airmen who believed in the Coast Guard airmen's oath, which was, it was an unofficial oath, which was, you have to go out, but you don't have to come back.
Right.
And they recognized every time they went out, that was the deal. That was the bargain that they made. And as you described, Doug, you know, John Pritchard was so frustrated earlier in the month that he couldn't, by plane, find these three lost Canadian airmen who had also gone down in Greenland, that he ends up leading the boat rescue. Yeah. And they are finally spotted. He says, "Now I'm taking the boat. I'm going to go to the shore. I'm going to climb the face of this glacier. I'm going to, you know, I'm going to go and traverse these open crevasses. I'm going to get these guys." And there's a picture in the book of just after having rescued them.
Yeah.
So Pritchard was extraordinary, and Bottoms as well. Bottoms could have gotten out of duty because he had an illness earlier in the year, but he immediately, as soon as he was well, he returned to be John Pritchard's radio man. And these are two, to this day, two of the greatest Coast Guard heroes in history.
Yeah. Bottoms is such a great character, too, for he married the daughter of a Gloucester fisherman. You mentioned his stepson talking about him. Now, here's a man from Georgia, if I'm not mistaken,
yes,
from the Deep South. But the one thing about him, we're talking about in the 1940s, of course, that his stepson remembers is the fact that he was not prejudice. He had no biases, that he would bring soldiers of different, you know, races, you know, by the house, which seems extraordinary for that time.
I agree. And Bud, his stepson, Bud Richardson, describes this with such such candor and it's so credible, where he describes Ben Bottoms bringing these men home. He would see a serviceman who was maybe at a bus stop going in to, you know, cause trouble down in the blood and guts bars of the Boston seafront, waterfront, and he would bring them home for Bud's mom, Olga, to make them dinner. And Bud quotes his stepfather saying, you know, different color skin, and I can't even do the quote justice without reading it, but people are people, and all in God's image. And to this day, Bud Richardson idolizes his stepfather,
yeah,
whom he lost as a boy.
There's the story from the past. I want to put that aside for a moment and talk about the story from the present, because this is where you become involved, and we meet a modern day character, Lou Sapienza. Let's talk about Lou. He's this president of this exploration company, devoted to recovering lost military planes and fallen servicemen. And you describe Lou as having, you say it this way, a large man with a big presence. Talk about Lou.
Sure. Lou's a remarkable guy. He's a dreamer. He is a Don Quixote-like character, which at times made me feel like Sancho Panza on the back of an ass.
Right.
Lou just sallies forth, and he is this big guy with this big presence, and you just get swept up in his belief that, of course, we can do this.
Yeah.
Well, but Lou, there's no money. But
right.
But of course we can do this. But we don't know exactly where they are. But what are you talking about? We'll be fine. And this sense of belief, this sense of mission, this sense of refusing to take no is almost a cliche, but that really is how he was as he set his mind to finding the duck and finding the three men, Pritchard and Bottoms and a member of the B-17 crew, Lauren Howarth, who were lost all these years.
Right.
And he just set his mind to it and devoted himself emotionally, financially, physically, and he refused to let anything get in his way.
Yeah. You mentioned in the book one of his distinguishing characteristics is his sense of faith. In this, faith in this national commitment to leave no man behind, which I have to say, Mitchell Zuckoff, seemed like a theme throughout the book in some way.
I appreciate that. That was definitely by intent. That was again and again, both in the first three planes in 1942, the guys who went down first, Homer McDowell and his crew, the B-17 crew understood it could have been them, and so they did not want to leave those guys behind. And the Duck crew understood that the B-17 crew could have been them.
Yeah.
We can't leave these men out there without doing everything possible. And then flash forward 70 years, and you have Lou Sapienza saying, okay, these guys gave their lives for this country. We understand they're dead. We understand they're gone. But they deserve to be brought home. Their families deserve to know that they've been buried on U.S. soil, and they deserve the honors that they've earned. Mm. And so that leave no man behind absolutely is a driving theme.
We should explain the Department of Defense has this office devoted to bring home those captured or killed while serving their country. And so you write about this meeting with Lou, and you're there too, where he has to make this pitch. He's trying to get the federal government to give him some money to go back to Greenland, as you say, find the duck and excavate it. And we'll sort of get to that process as we go. But talk about the pitch, because Lou's such an interesting guy. I mean, the federal government, they have only so much money. There's this kind of equation that the government uses in these operations, mm-hmm. this ratio of cost to recoveries that you talk about. And Lou wants $1 million for this operation.
Yeah.
That's a lot of money.
You know, the folks from the two agencies are called DPMO, and JPAC is the big one, the Joint POW-MIA Accounting Command. And for $30,000 or so, they can go to Europe and dig up a farmer's field and sometimes bring home a lost serviceman.
Yeah.
Well, Lou is saying, I want, 30 times that, 40 times that to go to Greenland.
Yeah.
And they're sitting around the table, and it was excruciating for me because, I thought I could see things clearly. And what they were saying was, God, we're giving this guy some time, but that's all we're giving him.
Yeah.
There's no chance of this. And he's going on and he's going on. And I think he thinks he's doing pretty well. But then as the meeting hits about the 2-hour mark, he starts to flag. Their questions become more pointed. And almost a little bit of sarcasm starts to come out of some of the members around the table. And I'm doodling in my notebook, essentially drawing, making a little picture of the duck and drawing, the universal slash line through it, that this is not going to happen.
Yeah.
And but Lou doesn't. One of his great strengths is that he doesn't hear any of that.
Yeah. There's another character we should mention, Jim Blow, from the Coast Guard, who kind of comes in. In some way, and helps save Lou at this moment, and he becomes an important part of the present story because he offers a bit of hope that the Coast Guard can help in some way.
Exactly. Jim is a commander in the Coast Guard, a remarkable guy, great guy. And at that moment, I had talked to him on the phone. I didn't really know him at that time. He sweeps in, and I've always and always will see him as a descendant of John Pritchard at that moment. He's not going to leave Lou behind.
Yeah.
He comes up and he says, he's the director of aviation resources at the Coast Guard headquarters in Washington. And he says, if you ask for us for a C-130 transport plane and I'm going to try and make that happen. And it's such a bolt out of the blue. And yet it's so like Jim Blow. He he's a guy who steps up and who believes that what Pritchard and Bottoms did deserves this kind of attention. Mm.
Mitchell Zuckoff is with us. His book is called Frozen in Time, an epic story of survival and a modern quest for lost heroes of World War II. We need to take another brief break, but we'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with the journalist Mitchell Zuckoff. We're talking about his new book, Frozen in Time, an epic story of survival and a modern quest for lost heroes of World War II. Mitchell Zuckoff, so I'm going to be really careful not to give too much away. But let's say we're at the point in this story, going back now to 1942, where the group who have survived from this B-17 crash end up living under the wing of the plane in this snow cave. And they are found. I mean, there's no way to get them at this point. But there is a way to sort of get supplies to them and try to keep their spirits up. There's a section in the book I want to have you read because it's a remarkable moment. They're trying to keep their spirits up. So they get new uniforms, for example, dropped down to them. They play these word games. But then you talk about how, though, they still spend these long periods of silence, and they go through this kind of cycle where one of them will be depressed, one of them will be up, but finally things start to unravel. And it just so happens that they're all depressed at one time, and they hatched this suicide pact. Set up this reading for us. Give us a sense of what's going on.
Sure. This is in the midst of an Arctic winter. There's very little sunlight. There's 20 hours or so of darkness. They have been going through these cycles of depression where always, you know, one would break down and the others would kind of pull him out, and then the other one would break down. And they had run out of word games to play, and they had told each other their life stories time and time again. And they started thinking, you know, three men who had been sent to rescue them were already had died. Yeah. Two of them had been their crewmates. One of them says, you know, why should anyone else stick their neck out to save us? We have them scratch us off the books.
Yeah.
And so they decided they start talking about different ways to kill themselves. Should we walk into a crevasse? Should we just huddle up here in our little snow cave? And they informed they decided that the next time that their supply plane flown by this remarkable pilot, Pappy yeah. Turner,
another great
came character. Overhead, they would tell him, okay, stop coming. You guys are in danger every time you fly over the ice cap in the middle of February. Stop. You've done enough. Days passed before the next supply flight arrived, and in that time they reconsidered. They steeled themselves and agreed that suicide was a coward's way out. They vowed not to break down again, but it was a vow they couldn't keep. They resumed the cycle of hopelessness as one man gave up, then the next, and then the next. Pappy Turner's plane returned as they wallowed in despair. They told him via walkie-talkie that they appreciated all in his crew had done, but supply and morale-sustaining services were no longer required. Pappy Turner couldn't believe his ears. Normally even-keeled, he flew into a rage. He and his men had busted their humps to keep the PN-9E crew alive, and now they wanted to die? Turner bawled them out, telling the trio that until now he thought they'd have guts. He'd thought that they were strong enough to stick it out, that they were soldiers, but he must have been mistaken. Gaining steam, Turner called them a bunch of weaklings. He told them he was so revolted that he felt half tempted to accept their plan and let them freeze or starve to death. But the choice wasn't his or even theirs to make. Turner told Monteverdi, Clint Best, and Paul Spina that they were the last three pieces of the most expensive rescue of the war. The U.S. government had invested too many lives, too much time and effort, and too much money to let them die now. When he calmed down, Turner promised that he and his crew wouldn't stop flying until the three men were off the ice. In exchange, he made Monteverdi, Best, and Spina promise that they'd refuse to quit.
It's so interesting, the notes he sends along, too. This effort to sort of keep them buoyed up. It's kind of such a lovely moment, I have to say, this part of the story.
I agree. He Pappy Turner was a little bit old. They called him Pappy because he was all of, I think, 40 years old.
Right. So
to them, he was the old man.
Yeah.
But in that time, he understood. He, I think, empathized deeply with them. And so he would sign these notes, you know, the boys or the guys, that they were there with them. He would tell them, you know, we're not going to stop. Hey, we're dropping a new walkie-talkie. Here's what you do. We're going to try and get some mail to you. And he would do these pinpoint drops because he knew that, you know, they could replace supplies or rations, but they couldn't replace a letter from a loved one back home. Mm. And so he would endanger himself again and again to get these guys what they needed. And I think I was so glad all these guys who could saved those notes, because they knew that those notes really were these beacons for them,
yeah,
that they would read and reread and know that somebody was out there trying to get them.
Well, it's hard to get to them is the point here, of course, which then brings in another great character, Bernt Balken, a Norwegian-born army pilot. And he is such an extraordinary character. He almost seems not real, I have to say, in some way. I mean, he's the son of this country doctor and born in Norway. He joins the French Foreign Legion when he's a teenager. He lies about his age to get into World War I with the Finnish cavalry. His horse is shot out from under him. He's left on the battlefield. He's this champion skier. He's this cyclist. He's a boxer. He's an expert marksman. He's an amazing character, and I wanted you to talk about him as well, because now he comes into the picture.
Yeah, and you know, it's funny, Doug, everything you mentioned, I think, happened to Bernt Balken before he was 20.
Right, right.
You know, right. And then he goes on and lives this extraordinary life. He realizes he's destined to be an airman, and he loves flying. He ends up teaching Amelia Earhart how to fly using instruments. He becomes one of her teachers, one of her instructors. He becomes one of the great Arctic airmen of the age. He's fearless. He's a brilliant flyer. And he is recruited by the United States to open one of these bases in Greenland, because they know Bernt Balken knows more, has forgotten more about flying in Greenland than anybody else on the planet knows.
Right.
And so he opens this, it's called BW-8, base. And when he hears that this B-17 crew is down, he pretty much commandeers a commercial plane, because it's the right plane for the job. And he gets a volunteer crew, and he just solo goes out and, figuring based on where they were supposed to be searching, he goes looking for them.
Yeah.
And so first he finds them, and then he becomes the guy who's supposed to rescue them, because, again, he knows more about this place. He knows how to fly here. And he comes with this incredible, half-crazy plan. You know, if you thought, okay, the first idea was, well, they landed this duck, this Grumman duck we talked about, this amphibious plane, on a glacier.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Bernt Balken comes up with this idea. We're going to land a plane about four times the size of that on a glacier. I'm going to fill it with dog sleds and experienced glacier men. And we're going to walk or climb or dig or whatever it takes to get to these guys. And we're going to turn the ice cap into a runway. And we're going to get this, it's called a PBY, it's patrol bomber, you know, to get them off the ice. And it, first of all, you know, the Navy says, essentially, you're insane. You know, thanks very much for coming. And he goes kind of around them and gets the Army involved, and the Army supports him. And that becomes the rescue plan.
Mm. Well, it brings us back to the sort of modern-day story. And we mentioned Lou Sapienza, who's trying to get some money for this expedition. And this is where you come in, Mitch Zukov. You used your advance for this book to help pay for this expedition and your American Express card. So this is where you get invested in the story. I guess you're all in at this point, right? And you can't not let it happen, I suppose?
That's exactly it. That is the feeling that it's if it's about giving the advance and my credit card number to Lou, I can't not do it. But I have to tell you, Doug, you haven't lived until your wife picks up the phone from the American Express fraud people wondering, did Mitch in fact mean to buy a rifle, a shotgun, and some polar bear deterrent equipment? And to her credit, she just turned to me and said, "It's for you."
Right.
And so Lou blew through the limits that I had set him on the card. I think once in a while, it's okay. You get swept up in something, and I truly believed it. And kidding aside, I had come to know Nancy Pritchard, John Pritchard's younger sister, who is now 90. She's almost 91. And when I met her, she was about in her late 80s. And Nancy had been waiting 70 years since she was a teenage girl for her brother to come home. And it has affected her whole life. She married one of his close friends who he had picked for her. Mm-hmm. And they had a beautiful 60-year marriage with grandchildren and great-grandchildren now. And so I felt it wasn't just about fulfilling Lou's dream or this book's dream. It was about honoring Nancy's commitment to her brother. And so I was able to do that.
We've got a minute left. We should say this, and I'll put a link, by the way, to the blog you've been doing, because you went back to Greenland to and we should say that this expedition isn't finished. There's some sense that there's some controversy about this, but that you've found the duck. But the bodies haven't been recovered yet, and I wanted you to say something about that yet, finally. I guess this story is still unfinished.
It is, and I believe it will be finished, and I have every confidence that John Pritchard, Benjamin Bottoms, and Lauren Howarth will be brought home. And anything I can do to make that happen, I'm committed to.
Mitchell Zuckoff. His book is called Frozen in Time, an epic story of survival and a modern quest for lost heroes of World War II. He joined us from a studio in Brookline, Massachusetts. Mitchell Zuckoff, good to talk to you again. Thank you very much for the time.
Thank you, Doug. It was great.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, technical direction from Mike Anderson, the program produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.